A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's come down with a cold, and he noticed something. It started with sneezing, then the aches and that fluish feeling, now the full faucet nose situation. And he's wondering, why does a cold follow this script? Why sneezing first, not runny nose? What actually causes that streaming stage? And why do some colds clear up in days, while others drag on for weeks?
This is one of those questions where the answer is way more elegant than most people realize. The sequence isn't random, and it's not the virus calling the shots. It's your immune system running a choreographed response. The virus shows up, but the symptoms are almost entirely your body's doing. Think of it like a fire drill. The virus is the smoke, but the alarms, the sprinklers, the evacuation, that's all the building's own systems.
The cold is basically friendly fire.
That's exactly what it is. And the script is so predictable that you can practically set your watch by it. Sneezing within hours, aches around day 2 or 3, runny nose peaking around day 3 to 5. The virus, usually rhinovirus, sometimes coronavirus or RSV, triggers a cascade, but the cascade itself is your immune system following an ancient playbook. It's been refined by evolution for millions of years, and it runs the same way whether you're a human, a chimp, or a bat.
Walk me through the opening scene. Why sneezing first?
Sneezing is the bouncer at the door. Within hours of viral particles landing on your nasal mucosa, mast cells in the tissue detect something foreign and release histamine. Histamine is the chemical alarm. It binds to receptors on nerve endings, specifically the trigeminal nerve, which runs through your face and nasal passages. That nerve fires a signal straight to the medulla oblongata in the brainstem, which coordinates what's essentially a massive coordinated exhalation.
100 miles an hour, right? I've seen that number.
Up to 100 miles an hour, and droplets can travel 8 meters, about 26 feet. The point is to expel the virus before it establishes an infection. It's a preemptive strike. The virus has barely begun replicating at this stage, and your body is already trying to evict it. What's remarkable is how fast this happens. Mast cells can degranulate within seconds of detecting a pathogen. It's one of the fastest immune responses we have.
Which explains why you sneeze most in the first day or two, and then it tapers off.
The sneezing is most intense when the viral load is still mostly on the surface, in the nasal passages, before it's penetrated deeper into the respiratory epithelium. Once the virus gets into cells and starts replicating, the battle shifts. That's when you move into the aches and fever phase.
What about the people who never sneeze at all with a cold? I've known folks who skip straight to the runny nose.
That's partly about where the virus lands, and partly about individual variation in mast cell sensitivity. If the initial inoculum is deeper in the nasopharynx, say you inhaled it, rather than it landing right at the entrance of your nostrils, the mast cells in that region might not be as densely packed, so the sneeze reflex isn't triggered as strongly. And some people simply have less reactive trigeminal nerves. It's like how some people sneeze when they look at the sun and others don't. There's a neurological variability there.
The photic sneeze reflex. I have that. It's ridiculous.
It's a crossed wiring thing. But back to the timeline, day 2 or 3, Daniel said he felt fluish and achy. That's the innate immune system going into full battle mode. This is where interferons and cytokines come in. Interleukin-1, interleukin-6, tumor necrosis factor alpha. These are signaling proteins that coordinate the immune response. They're released by infected cells and by immune cells like macrophages. And they have systemic effects.
Systemic meaning they don't just stay in your nose.
IL-1 and IL-6 travel to the hypothalamus, which is your brain's thermostat, and they reset it upward. That's the fever. They also cause muscle inflammation and joint pain. That's the achiness. Your body is essentially making itself a less hospitable environment for the virus while mobilizing immune cells. The achiness isn't the virus attacking your muscles. It's your own cytokines causing inflammation as a side effect of ramping up the immune response.
You feel like you've been hit by a truck, because your immune system is the truck.
You're both the driver and the road. The fever itself is functional. Every 1 degree Celsius increase in body temperature speeds up immune cell division by about 20%. It also directly inhibits viral replication for some viruses. Rhinovirus actually replicates better at slightly below normal body temperature, around 33 degrees Celsius, which is the temperature of the nasal passages when you're breathing cool air. That's one reason your nose is the entry point. The virus has adapted to prefer the cooler temperatures of the upper respiratory tract. It's also why your mom was right about not going out with wet hair. Not because the wet hair itself causes a cold, but because cooling your nasal passages creates a more favorable environment for any rhinovirus that's already there.
That's a fascinating detail. The virus prefers it cooler. So the fever is literally making your body too hot for the virus to function well.
It's a two-pronged strategy. Heat stresses the virus and speeds up your own defenses. It's elegant. But here's something people don't appreciate. The fever also changes your behavior. It makes you want to lie down, stay still, conserve energy. That behavioral shift is part of the immune strategy. Your body is saying, stop moving around and divert all available energy to the immune response.
Which brings us to the runny nose stage. Daniel's in it now. What's actually happening?
Around day 3 to 5, the adaptive immune system is kicking in. This is the more sophisticated, targeted response. Neutrophils and other immune cells flood the nasal mucosa. Neutrophils are like the infantry. They're abundant, aggressive, and they'll take out anything that looks suspicious. They release enzymes, including one called myeloperoxidase.
That's the one that changes the color.
And this is a huge misconception people have. Green or yellow mucus does not mean a bacterial infection. It means neutrophils are doing their job. Myeloperoxidase is an enzyme that produces hypochlorous acid, basically bleach, to kill pathogens. It has a greenish tint. When enough neutrophils show up and release this enzyme, your mucus changes from clear to yellow to green. It's a normal viral cold, not a reason for antibiotics.
That alone is worth the price of admission. How many millions of antibiotic prescriptions have been written because someone saw green snot and assumed bacteria?
It's a massive driver of unnecessary antibiotic use. I've seen estimates that up to 30% of antibiotic prescriptions for upper respiratory infections are written primarily because the patient, or the doctor, saw discolored mucus and got nervous. It's one of the most persistent myths in medicine. Patients come in and say, it's green, so I need antibiotics, and it's hard to unconvince them in a 10-minute appointment.
How do you explain it to someone in a way that sticks? The bleach analogy.
The bleach analogy helps. I tell people, imagine you're cleaning your bathroom and you use a bleach-based cleaner. The greenish color isn't the mold, it's the cleaning product. Same thing in your nose. The green is the neutrophil's cleaning product. It's actually a sign your immune system is handling things, not a sign things are getting worse.
That's a great way to frame it. But back to the streaming nose. The technical term is rhinorrhea. What's happening is vasodilation and increased capillary permeability in the nasal mucosa. The blood vessels widen and become leaky, and plasma literally seeps into the nasal passages. Meanwhile, goblet cells ramp up mucus production to trap viral debris and flush it out. Your nose is running because your body is deliberately flooding the area to wash out the enemy. The sequence is, histamine alarm triggers sneezing to expel the virus at the door, then cytokines mobilize the heavy artillery and cause systemic symptoms, then the adaptive response floods the battlefield and washes out the debris. It's a three-act play.
The playwright is evolution. This script is conserved across mammals because it works. The fire alarm analogy is useful. Sneezing is the smoke detector going off, the aches and fever are the fire department arriving with sirens blaring, and the runny nose is the hoses flooding the building.
I want to pause on that flooding stage, because Daniel specifically asked what causes the streaming. Is it mostly plasma leaking from blood vessels, or mostly mucus production ramping up?
It's both, but the plasma leakage is the bigger contributor to the sheer volume. When those capillaries become permeable, the fluid that leaks out is essentially the liquid component of blood without the cells. It's serum. That's why early runny nose fluid is thin and watery. It's mostly serum. The goblet cells contribute thicker, stickier mucus later in the process. So the progression you notice. First, it's like a dripping faucet with thin, clear fluid, then it gets thicker and more viscous. That's the shift from predominantly plasma leakage to predominantly mucus production.
That's exactly Daniel's description. He said it started like water, now it's more like glue.
The plasma phase is the body trying to physically wash out viral particles. The mucus phase is about trapping debris and creating a barrier so the virus can't spread to new cells. Different tools for different stages of the same fight.
That's the sequence. But why does the whole production take 3 days for some people and 3 weeks for others? Daniel mentioned that too. He's had colds that were gone by the weekend and colds that overstayed their visa.
This is where it gets interesting. The key variable is how quickly your adaptive immune system can mount a specific response. And that depends almost entirely on whether your body has seen this particular virus before.
Which is complicated by the fact that there are, what, over 100 rhinovirus serotypes?
Over 160 known serotypes. And they're immunologically distinct. Antibodies against serotype A don't neutralize serotype B. So you can get a cold, recover, and get another cold 2 weeks later from a different serotype, and your immune system treats it like a brand new enemy.
Which is why we never develop lasting immunity to the common cold.
But here's the nuance. If you get infected with a rhinovirus serotype you've encountered before, even years ago, you have memory B cells and memory T cells that recognize it. Those memory cells can spring into action within 24 to 48 hours. They start producing IgG antibodies almost immediately, and they can shut down the infection before symptoms peak. That's your 3 to 5 day cold.
The quick one.
The quick one. But if you encounter a novel serotype, one your immune system has never seen, you're starting from scratch. Naive B cells need 7 to 10 days to go through affinity maturation and produce effective antibodies. During that time, the virus is replicating unchecked, and the innate immune system is doing all the heavy lifting. That's your 2 to 3 week cold.
There was a study on this, wasn't there? Quantifying the difference.
Yes. A 2023 study in Nature Immunology found that prior exposure to a specific rhinovirus serotype reduced symptom duration by an average of 4.2 days compared to a novel serotype. That's a massive difference. And it's entirely explained by memory B cell response speed.
When Daniel's cold drags on for weeks, it's not that the virus is nastier. It's that his immune system is meeting it for the first time.
Though there are other factors. Viral load at infection matters. If someone sneezes directly in your face, you're getting a much bigger inoculum than if you touch a doorknob and then your eye. Higher viral load means the virus gets a head start before the immune system catches up.
How big a difference does the inoculum size actually make? Is it linear, or is there a threshold?
It's not perfectly linear. There's a minimum infectious dose, and then beyond that, more virus generally means faster onset and potentially more severe symptoms. But it's hard to study ethically because you'd have to deliberately infect people with different doses. The data we have comes from challenge studies, where volunteers are given measured doses. Those show that a tenfold increase in viral particles can shorten the incubation period by about half a day and increase peak symptom severity by maybe 20 to 30%. It's not trivial.
The virus itself varies. RSV versus rhinovirus, for example.
RSV is a different beast. Respiratory syncytial virus has a longer incubation period, 4 to 6 days versus 1 to 3 for rhinovirus. But more importantly, RSV produces a protein called NS1 that directly suppresses interferon signaling. It actively sabotages the innate immune response, which prolongs the whole timeline. Adenoviruses can be even longer, up to 2 weeks of symptoms, because they're DNA viruses with more complex replication cycles.
The virus species matters, the serotype matters, the dose matters, and your personal immune history matters. No wonder colds are so variable.
We haven't even gotten to host genetics. Your HLA type, human leukocyte antigen, the proteins that present viral fragments to T cells, varies enormously between people. Some HLA types are better at presenting rhinovirus peptides than others. If you have an HLA type that's a poor match for a particular virus, your T cell response will be slower and weaker.
Which is purely genetic luck.
There's also age. Children average 6 to 8 colds a year, adults 2 to 3. That's partly exposure, kids are germ factories, but also their adaptive immune systems are less experienced. By middle age, you've encountered enough serotypes that a higher proportion of your colds are repeat encounters.
What about the other end of the age spectrum? Elderly people. Do colds hit them differently?
They do, and it's one of the less appreciated aspects of immunosenescence. As we age, the naive T cell pool shrinks. Your thymus, the organ where T cells mature, starts involuting after puberty and is mostly replaced by fat by age 65. So when an older person encounters a novel rhinovirus serotype, they have fewer naive T cells available to mount a response. The cold might not be more severe symptomatically, but it often lasts longer and has a higher risk of secondary complications like pneumonia.
The older you get, the more you're relying on your memory bank of previous exposures, and the less able you are to handle brand new variants.
It's like a library that stops acquiring new books but keeps the old ones. Great if someone asks for a classic, not so great if they want something published last week.
What about the lingering cough? Daniel didn't ask about it specifically, but it's the thing that drives people crazy. You feel fine, you're back at work, but you're still hacking 3 weeks later.
That's not the virus. That's repair. The respiratory epithelium takes a beating during a viral infection. The virus infects and kills epithelial cells, and the immune response causes inflammation and damage. The cilia, those tiny hair-like structures that sweep mucus out of your airways, get destroyed. A 2024 study from the University of Virginia showed that cilia take 2 to 4 weeks to fully regrow after a viral respiratory infection.
You're coughing because your lungs can't clear themselves properly.
The cough reflex is compensating for lost ciliary function. Mucus accumulates, irritates the airway, and you cough to move it. It's not infection, it's infrastructure repair. That's why cough syrup doesn't really help. The problem isn't the cough reflex, it's the damaged epithelium that's triggering it.
Which also explains why the cough gets worse at night. Your horizontal mucus pools, more irritation.
Cortisol levels drop at night, which reduces the body's natural anti-inflammatory signal. So the airway inflammation that was being partly suppressed during the day flares up.
Is there anything that actually helps the post-viral cough? People try everything. Honey, steam, cough drops.
Honey has some evidence. A 2021 meta-analysis found it modestly reduced cough frequency and severity in children, probably through a combination of coating the throat and mild antimicrobial properties. Steam can help loosen mucus temporarily, but it doesn't speed healing. The honest answer is time. The cilia need to regrow, and that's a biological process you can't rush. The one thing I'd caution against is using suppressants like dextromethorphan heavily. You're better off coughing productively than suppressing the reflex and letting mucus pool in your airways.
Let me pivot to something Daniel mentioned. He said he powers through with extra coffee. I have a suspicion about where this is going.
I wish I could tell you coffee helps. But caffeine is a mild immunosuppressant. It increases cyclic AMP inside cells, which reduces the production of pro-inflammatory cytokines. Those cytokines are what make you feel awful, so in theory, coffee might make you feel slightly better. But they're also what fight the virus. Blunting your cytokine response could prolong the infection.
The power-through strategy is counterproductive.
The evidence isn't definitive. We don't have large randomized trials on coffee and cold duration. But mechanistically, it's plausible that caffeine extends recovery time. At minimum, it can interfere with sleep, and sleep is when your immune system does some of its best work. T cell activity peaks during deep sleep.
There was that study about sleep and vaccine response, wasn't there? People who slept poorly after a flu shot produced fewer antibodies?
Yes. A 2022 study showed that people who slept less than 6 hours a night in the days following vaccination had significantly lower antibody titers. The same principle applies to natural infection. Sleep is when your body consolidates the immune response. If you're powering through on caffeine and 4 hours of sleep, you're handicapping your own recovery.
The conventional wisdom, rest, fluids, don't push it, is actually grounded in immunology.
And there's a stronger case for letting a fever run its course within reason. Fever helps your immune system work faster. Every 1 degree Celsius increase speeds up immune cell proliferation by about 20%. If you take ibuprofen or acetaminophen to suppress a moderate fever, you might be slowing down your own recovery.
As a line, at what point do you treat the fever?
Above 39 degrees Celsius, about 102 Fahrenheit. In adults, the risks start to outweigh the benefits. And in children, febrile seizures are a concern, so the threshold is lower. But for a typical cold fever of 38 to 38.5, letting it ride is probably beneficial.
Same logic for the runny nose? Don't suppress it?
Decongestants and antihistamines will dry you up, but they're also interfering with the flushing mechanism. The runny nose is clearing viral debris. If you block it, you're keeping that debris in your nasal passages longer. Whether that meaningfully prolongs the infection is debated, but the theoretical case is there.
What does help? Daniel mentioned he's not into home remedies, but there's zinc, right?
Zinc is one of the few things with decent evidence. It inhibits rhinovirus replication by blocking ICAM-1, which is the receptor rhinovirus uses to enter cells. But the window is narrow. It needs to be started within 24 hours of symptom onset. After 48 hours, the benefit drops significantly because the virus is already established.
It has to be zinc lozenges, not pills.
Right, the local concentration in the throat matters. Zinc gluconate or zinc acetate lozenges dissolve slowly in the mouth. The Cochrane review found about a 30% reduction in duration if started early. But the taste is unpleasant, and some people get nausea. It's not a miracle.
What about vitamin C? That's the classic.
Large analyses show no preventive effect in the general population. Taking vitamin C daily doesn't reduce your chance of catching a cold. It may slightly reduce duration, by about 8% in adults, if taken daily before getting sick. But starting vitamin C after symptoms appear doesn't seem to help. The effect is small enough that it's probably not worth the effort for most people.
The actionable advice from all of this is, let the fever do its thing unless it's high. Don't rush to suppress the runny nose. Zinc might help if you catch it in the first 24 hours. And coffee is maybe not your friend here.
If a cold lasts more than 14 days, it's worth questioning whether it's actually a cold. Sinusitis, allergies, and even COVID-19 can present identically in early stages. The CDC's 2025 guidance recommends testing if symptoms persist past day 10.
That's a useful rule of thumb. Day 10 and you're still miserable. Maybe get tested.
And the green mucus thing again. If you take one thing from this episode, let it be that green snot is not a reason to ask for antibiotics. It's neutrophils. It's normal. It means your immune system is working.
The immune system's calling card. We were here. We bleached the place.
That's basically it. Myeloperoxidase leaves a signature. It's the immune system's version of a Kilroy was here. Graffiti tag.
We've walked through the whole timeline. The histamine alarm, the cytokine mobilization, the neutrophil cleanup, the cilia regrowth. And the duration variability comes down to immunological memory, viral factors, and genetics. But there's a bigger question hanging over all of this. If the immune system script is so predictable, why can't we design drugs that accelerate the transition from innate to adaptive immunity? Skip the miserable middle part.
That's exactly the right question, and it's where the research is heading. There's a class of molecules called TLR agonists, toll-like receptor agonists, that essentially jumpstart the adaptive immune system. Toll-like receptors are pattern recognition receptors that detect viral components. If you activate them artificially, you can potentially shorten the lag time between innate and adaptive response.
Instead of waiting 7 days for naive B cells to figure things out, you give them a push.
The concept is sound, but the challenge is doing it without triggering a cytokine storm. The innate response is inflammatory for a reason. It needs to be. If you accelerate the adaptive response too aggressively, you risk the kind of uncontrolled inflammation that makes some COVID cases severe. It's a delicate balance.
How close are we to something like that being available? Are we talking years or decades?
There are TLR agonists in clinical trials for other applications. Some are used as vaccine adjuvants already. But for treating an active cold, we're probably a decade out at minimum. The therapeutic window is narrow. You'd need to take it at exactly the right moment, and the risk of over-amplifying the immune response is real. It's not like taking an antihistamine where the side effects are drowsiness and dry mouth. The side effect here could be a cytokine storm that lands you in the eye, see you.
The cure could be worse than the cold.
Potentially much worse. That's the fundamental challenge of immunomodulation. The immune system is a network of feedback loops, not a simple on-off switch. Push one part and five other parts respond in ways that are hard to predict.
There's a vaccine angle too, right? A cold vaccine has always been the holy grail that nobody could reach because of all those serotypes.
160 serotypes makes a traditional vaccine nearly impossible, but the approach has shifted. Instead of targeting the variable surface proteins that differ between serotypes, researchers are looking at conserved proteins, parts of the virus that don't change much because they're structurally essential. If you can find a conserved target and train the immune system against it, you might get broad protection across serotypes.
The NIH launched something on this recently.
Phase 1 trial in March of this year, 2026. It's early, but it's the first time a cold vaccine has made it to human trials. The target is a conserved region of the rhinovirus capsid protein VP1. If it works, it would be a genuine breakthrough.
A universal cold vaccine. That would change winter.
It would change everything. The economic impact alone, colds cost the U.S. economy something like $40 billion a year in lost productivity, not to mention the misery.
The coffee industry might take a hit.
Small price to pay. But even putting the vaccine aside, I think the most practical takeaway from all of this is that cold symptoms aren't random suffering. They're functional. Each stage has a purpose. Understanding that doesn't make the cold more pleasant, but it makes it less mysterious. When Daniel's nose is streaming, he can at least know that his neutrophils are doing exactly what they're supposed to do.
There's something almost satisfying about that. Your body knows the script. It's been running this play for a few hundred million years. You don't need to interfere. You mostly need to get out of the way and let it work.
Rest, hydrate, and resist the urge to power through with coffee.
Daniel's gonna love that advice. And to wrap this up, the sequence is a three-act immune drama. The variability is about immunological memory and viral diversity, and the lingering cough is infrastructure repair, not infection. Your body isn't failing you. It's executing a program, sometimes slowly, sometimes imperfectly, but with a logic you can trace.
Green snot is neutrophils.
Spread the word. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The largest stony meteorite ever found in Niger is the Mount Tazersite meteorite, which weighed approximately 110 kilograms when discovered in the early 1980s. It is an L5 ordinary chondrite, meaning it contains spherical silicate droplets called chondrules that formed in the solar nebula 4.56 billion years ago. The meteorite is named after the mountain near where it was found, and it currently resides at the National Museum of Niger in Niamey. Chondrules like those in Mount Tazersite are among the oldest solid objects in the solar system. They predate the planets themselves.
Right.
I genuinely didn't know chondrules predate the planets.
That is actually interesting. Little time capsules from before Earth existed.
4.56 billion years. Puts a two-week cold in perspective.
It really does. So the next time you're in Niger in the 80s, look down.
That's your closing thought?
It's a good closing thought. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com or search for My Weird Prompts on Spotify. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Let your neutrophils do their thing.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.